33, 8 a.m. There's consideration of Senate Bill 190, work session, Senate Bill 159, work session, Senate Bill 209, hearing and work session.
Local government government affairs have come to order. This morning, we're going to consider three bills. One is SB 190, which is a work session. It's on subdivision class, and then SB 159, landlord and tenant, that is a work session. And SB 209, which concerns county service districts, where we'll take testimony and also have a work session. I think we'll take it in the order of SB 190 and SB 209 and SB 159. On SB 190, you have before you amendment dated March 16, 1973. It changes it considerably. I think what those amendments do is to does give the district improvement companies notice of these plats without giving them the rule of the planning body, and it requires any subdivider to submit those to those districts and companies for their approval, and they have 30 days to approve them and return them to the subdivider. If they don't do it within 30 days, then the subdivider can consider that being approved and then present it to the planning body, or there is a planning body to the governing body, however it's set up in the particular governmental unit. That personally satisfied, I seem to me it satisfied them, because they complained primarily about not having notice, and I think it also leads the process of the governing body and governmental unit to delegate planning responsibility. Yet they retain the ultimate authority on it. Is there any discussion on the amendment? I might comment that Senator Hardtum was Representative Hampton for the sponsors of this bill, and these amendments meet Senator Hardtum's approval.
Would you run that? I'm a little slow this morning, Chairman. I shouldn't have this morning, I'm a little slow, but all the subdivision plats located within the...
Are you reading in the amendments?
Well, I have to flow back and forth, but I'll pick up the amendment, yeah. All these plats, and all plats that are planned for vacating and so on, within the boundaries of the district or county, shall be submitted to the governing board of the district or the company by the subdivider, and a report of its recommendations obtained before the plan or plat is approved. A report of the
governing board of the district and by the subdivider.
And a report of its recommendations
obtained before the plan or plat is approved.
Okay. Now, who approves the plan and plat, and what are the recommendations they advert? Still,
I think it still goes right back to the land, and you go back to the subdivider, and then you go to the planning commission, and those recommendations are there, or rejected. Whatever the subdivision is going to do. And but if they don't act in 30 days, then that is
I think that's probably where you get from there, but I'll figure out kind of a lot of more.
Let's go to Senate Bill 209. Somebody signed up down there, I think. Mr. Shepherd, you're back.
I'm back. Yeah, we weren't sure he was going to be here. So we've divided the testimony between the two of us. I'm just reinforcing the point of view that 209 is extremely important to a project that the Committee on Aging is developing. And there are three points that we've...
Well, state your name on the table.
Excuse me. I'm Ruth Shepherd. I'm with the staff on the Committee on Aging and was asked to appear on their behalf.
Thank you.
3 points that we want to reinforce that we made last time. There are monies coming into the state, especially earmarked for transportation, and monies coming into the state which can be used at the local level for transportation, and we're particularly eager to see that local government is able to use those monies. One such source is an estimated amount as much as $100,000 for this biennium of federal money associated with a nutrition program for the elderly, one-tenth of which, and amounting to about $100,000, is supposed to be linked to that nutrition program for delivery of meals and delivery of people to congregate meals. And that money is going to be dispersed directly to local governments. And unless 209 makes it possible, they're going to be in a bind in order to get into the business of providing.
Are these federal funds?
They are federal funds, yes, sir. A national nutrition program has cleared Congress and cleared the OMB, as a matter of fact. Two other sources of revenues are realistic sources that we can expect local government to use on transportation, and especially for elderly. At this point, as I told you last week, we already have documented the interest and the willingness of local government to use general revenue funds, particularly for the purchase capital outlay of hardware such as buses and minibuses that we're much interested in for the senior citizens. And thirdly, it's expected within the next biennium, and certainly by the end of the second year, that revenue shared monies, so-called transportation shared monies from the federal level, will also be available. And eyeing those three sources and having worked with local government to quite an extent in their and trying to develop a willingness to support programs for the aging, why we feel there's enough evidence that this bill is being pushed from that direction too, and I just wanted to underline that evidence this morning.
I stated
one point, Senator Burns, and it is that monies are becoming available rapidly, and there are three sources of them. $100,000. Okay, the second one are general revenue funds that are now available to county governments.
General revenue funds from county governments?
From the federal resources to county governments, right. And the third one?
From the federal government to the county.
Right.
Are these revenue sharing?
Right now, available.
For transportation?
No. Revenue sharing, period. And if 0209 were a statute, they could use those monies for transport. Thirdly, we anticipate. Okay.
Is there any indication that the county governments are going to use their revenue sharing dollars for transportation?
I think at this point it would be termed illegal.
It would be illegal?
Yeah.
Well,
unless it's a home rule county, Senator Burns.
Yeah. I realize that. I'm talking about is there any indication that if it would be legal for them to do so, they've used the general revenue sharing money for federal government transportation?
Yes. Judge Bill Corky, for instance, of the Dalles area, has made a strong statement to that effect, and certain other counties, Eastern Oregon, would like to be able to do it too.
Now, this $100,000 we're talking about—that's the total amount. That's your point number one.
Yeah, that's an estimated amount. There's a little over $1 million anticipated in the next 2 years for that nutrition program.
For the whole area, the whole United States.
No, for the state of Oregon. And that will be dispensed from the state level to local governments and local units that will be directing programs for aging. One-tenth of that $1 million is earmarked for transportation in association with the nutrition program.
Mr. Chairman, Dennis Moore, Administrator of Mass Transit Division. I testified before on Senate Bill 209. There was some concern with Senator Meeker. Unfortunately, he's not here, but I have subsequently talked to him, and I think we've clarified the issue of Senate Bill 209 and its relationship with the TriMet bill that was introduced that would allow TriMet to contract its services out. Senate Bill 209 would allow a county to form a district and a contract with TriMet or provide their own transportation or use it as some type of mechanism to spend revenue sharing funds, local tax dollars, whatever a county wants to provide public transportation.
What was that of the bill? What's the number of that?
That was House Bill 2170.
And that gives the authority to TriMet. That doesn't have anything to do with giving authority to county.
No, sir. Well, it does give authority to TriMet, but TriMet really would only be able to contract with, Vancouver, Washington. Right now, it could not contract with any of its surrounding counties because they do not have the authority to get any way involved in public transportation. And this bill is a suggested approach to allow general law counties to get involved if they want to with public transportation. I subsequently have talked to legislative counsel with reference to another question that Senator Burns brought up, Senator John Burns, about the broadened law to give counties essentially home rule authority. Jane Gerhardt said in many cases, home rule counties will actually make reference to ORS Chapter 451 to allow home rule counties to get involved in county service districts. Her recommendation at that time was to have both, if it be the pleasure of the legislature to have both. I also got a call yesterday from a couple of people, one in the Dalles and one in Medford, and they asked me when this would be effective. I estimated if it were passed by the legislature, it would possibly be in September. Their concern was, at least in Medford area, the Dial-A-Bus project down there is funded with OEO funds, and they are going to terminate in June 30th, and was hoping that there might be, this law might become effective earlier than in September. I would assume it would take an emergency clause to accomplish that. I suggested that they address a letter to the committee, and I thought it would be here this morning. Unfortunately, it is not. Just couldn't get here in time. But the one supplemental request that I have received to relate to the committee is a request that an emergency clause be tacked onto it, so they have some tools to solve transportation problems effective July 1.
Just a comment or a question. If you recall, I brought up in the last hearing when the bill the possibility of Attorney General's hearing side was regarding the ability of the Mass Transit District to contract the county much better shed some light on this entire bill. And in my research, I found that not only do the Mass Transit District not have the power currently to contract other agencies, even if they do get that power in the House Bill 2170, the county without this bill couldn't enter into an agreement.
Your reservation question?
Yeah,
they
no longer exist.
Okay. I move it now. Do you want to move the emergency clause? I need it. Okay. Is there a motion to Senator Meeker, Mr. Moore pointed out there are some places now where they have OEO funds available for transportation purposes. It will not be available for very much longer, and they'd like to pick up with those new laws and hope to have the emergency clause attached to that. Is there a motion to put the emergency clause on Senate Bill 209 to discussion?
I assume it is necessary and I'll vote for it. But it's symptomatic of the absolute unbelievable inconsistency by which we legislate. We came down here in 67 and we had a big push on for TriMet. And at that time, I remember so well a statement I think Ron Seuss and Arnold Kogan made about the danger of proliferating one-shot multi-county service agencies. We proliferated TriMet and MSD and CRAG and all those agencies. And if Governor imposed his regional administrative district plan, we started talking about regional government. And I think there's merit in redefining regional government for the purpose of providing things like transportation and things which counties can't do. But here we're cluttering up the statute book with giving general law counties the wherewithal to provide public transportation services, and it just seems abundantly clear to me that except for perhaps lane-wearing staff in Multnomah, that by themselves itself, the rest of the county really can't effectively operate and maintain public transportation systems. I think the only way we're going to effectively do that through public transportation would be through the regional approach, whether it's through the county, counties on the free side, and I suppose, or whether by combination of counties like Tri-Net and Corinth. And I think there's an absolute no wrong. You start talking in terms of dot money or federal money, finance these things. However, meritorious, people like Ted Walker and Val, some of the people on the Ohio Cross, who can forget.
Is there any further discussion of the adoption of the emergency clause instead of the general school amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The motion
to send the clause due pass recommendation, Senator Jim. Any discussion of the motion? Clerk, call and roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carried. Senator Jern, did you want to carry it?
I will. I'm not leaving you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 190 with amendments for
the Senator Burns, on Senate Bill 190, you have some amendments there dated March 16, 1973 that were adopted this morning. In essence, what they do is, if you recall, these water districts and so forth are concerned that these plots are being taken to planning commissions and the governing bodies, and they really need to know what was going on. This provides that all such plans and plots like subdividers be submitted to the district and for their recommendation, and if they do not act on it in 30 days, then they're deemed approved, and then they proceed to go to the planning commission with them. I think it solves their problem with respect to notice, and yet it preserves the planning process that is set up by the particular unit of the government, or the county, the city, or whatever it is. The motion now is to support the pass recommendation as amended.
Are all the various districts now underlaid through the process? I mean, is that as water control or irrigation district?
I can't assure you that. I don't know.
What about vector control district?
Is there any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Haber.
Aye.
Senator Donovan.
I don't vote for it. Aye.
Senator Carson.
Aye.
Senator
Durkin.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed. Senator Carson was there. Okay, now set up Bill 159. On Senate Bill 159, you've got the memorandum dated March 14 on the face of it, pointing out rather extensive amendments. Going through there, you'll see that there's some sections that refer back to when they have been renumbered and continue to say sections 1 through 44, while only We only have 1 through 40 now in the amendments with a few technicalities like that, but I think it might be possible going through through the change we have. I think the Charlie Williams worked on it and the Dean worked on it. Was there somebody from Legislative Council work on this too?
Tom Dorfman did. He's a number site, he'll be right there.
Was there anybody else that worked on it? Okay. Charlie wants to come on up here and we'll go through this. There might be some questions. Mm-hmm. So we start there on the first page of the bill. Stricken out the reference to a uniform law.
There are only 40 sections now.
Only 40 sections.
So that ought to be changed.
Yes, and you'll find that throughout, but that has not been changed.
Does that make any sense, Mr. Chairman?
Pardon me?
Does that make the bill more simple?
Well, in a way, right.
Legislative Council would like to get these back if the committee adopts them in principle, clean up things like that. Just clean up things like that. We just spent one afternoon going over there.
Charlie, why was Section 6 on page 2 taken out?
Well, simply because we thought it already that anybody can enter a settlement anytime they want to, and it's
right.
Something that's superfluous in the law.
Mr. Chairman, can we start right from the preamble?
Okay.
Just, I have a basic version of the preamble. Section 2 applies and rules construction, but really, I wonder if something more than a preamble, it says rules, you know, literally construed applies to the motor's underlying purpose.
That's on page 1.
Page 1.
Line 2.
Underlying purposes are to simplify, clarify, modernize, and revise. Well, you can't literally construe simplify, clarify, modernize, revise.
What about B now?
Okay. To ensure landlords can maintain and improve the quality of housing, that's the only one that I would think could possibly be the purpose. You know, the preamble, but is the landlord's and tenant's purpose to improve the quality of housing? Is it the housing act or landlord and tenant act? Or both?
I think you can choose both.
Okay, well, I just don't. As one senator here doesn't like memorials, I don't like preambles. And although this is a rule of construction, I think that's good.
I'll write another preamble by you if you don't like either.
Pardon?
I'll write another preamble by you.
Is that the one I'm going to get to read tomorrow? That's the one that I've read.
That's
oh, that's good. Yeah, that's okay. Let's leave it.
You want to move the strike? You want to strike Section 2?
If there's feeling for the committee that it's some purpose, I don't feel that strongly about it. My preference would be to remove it, but
I'm not
going to
make that.
All right, I'm going to move Section 2.
I don't think it matters, especially.
Any discussion of the motion? All in favor of removing the ballot for Section 2, indicated by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Yeah, I appreciate that.
And I am voting for it all.
Great.
Yeah. All right.
That's one in a row.
Now, let's go over to Section 8, Sub 1, where they have included by amendment educational housing that's off campus and non-dormitory. Recall we had rather extensive testimony on that subject from Eugene in particular.
Section 4.
No, Section 8 and Sub 1 of page 2.
Oh,
I see. It includes all that housing. University of Oregon runs off campus. Brings it under the under SB 159.
I've talked to our vice chancellor for facilities about this, Mr. Hundrup, and he has no hang up about what you're trying to include is married student housing. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what I'd like to get at is the housing to purchase around the campus that are really single family residences for the most part that you're now holding some assignment standards to some capital concerns down the line.
They're within the campus boundaries and ultimately will be taken down.
But they weren't designed as dormitories. They were just like any other single family rental. And you're really in a single family rental business.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones I'd like to get at. I think
I got it. John, do you want to come up here? I got it from this. It includes off campus housing, but not off campus dormitory housing. Is that correct?
Right. Like, I think Portland State has some dormitories that aren't really on a campus. So.
No, that's not correct. That's owned by a separate corporation. I would strike the word university because I think you want to include colleges too.
I guess that doesn't change anything, Charlie.
I'd substitute higher education or something like that for.
Well, what about just educational except off campus, non dormitory housing? Is that?
I think I'd do it. I realize that.
So we exempt?
No, this brings them in. Is that it?
Well,
we're off campus.
Just off, they're off campus, non dormitory.
Non-dormitory, not in the building.
Carson, you moving the section 6 up there, the chicken and this language there, section 8, subsection 1, the adopted.
Section 6 is 6?
I'm sorry.
I was thinking of that.
This amendment would read except off campus non dormitory housing.
Right.
You've heard the motion. Any discussion? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the next thing that's been stricken is all of Section 9, which gives jurisdiction to circuit court, district court, and various other things. And I mentioned several times, I think all of us would like to find some inexpensive way for landlord-tenant disputes to be handled. In spite of where we looked at what we attempted to find, I don't think we find any better solution than leave them in small claims court if we could find some way of dissuading either the parties from removing it to district court, which nobody's done yet. We do have one proposal where the parties can agree to arbitration for that sort of thing. I see this goes on for about 2 or 3 pages, and I don't think it'd be very helpful. We checked up in Multnomah County on the respect to time spent in small claims court on landlord-tenant problems, and it was estimated that small claims occupied one judge one half day, 5 days per week, and between 25% and 50% of the time is landlord-tenant dispute. FED take about 15 minutes per day, 5 days a week, and if they are contested cases, of course, might take more time than that. But it doesn't seem to be such a large amount that it's that much of a burden on the court if it's left for small claims court. So I don't know of a better solution than just using small claims court, so if we can find any way to dissuade the party from removal. And this is going beyond striking this section, but there are no attorney fees in small claims court, of course. And if we leave the attorney fee provision, and we go over here a little ways further, we'll take that when we come to it about leaving attorney fees in for the prevailing party, that may dissuade people from removing it from the district court. But anyway, Section 9 just eliminates all the granting jurisdiction of certain courts and so forth, and it isn't really necessary as long as we've got our present procedure. Okay, a motion to delete, has been made to delete Section 9. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? All right, Section 9 is deleted. We got some more of those sections 1 to 44 here, but let's just leave those go and let the council will clean that up. Now you got the definitions there. Those have been unchanged. That's in section, new section 6. Yeah. And in section 7, the obligation of good faith. Go on, unless you raise some questions or something, and then on Section 8, unconscionability. On that court, Mr. Chairman,
pardon me, this court will not be
enough. It'll go into small, well, it's a mouse. Small claims court has jurisdiction up to $500 now, is that right, Judge? $500.
I don't know whether Senate Bill 450 raised it $500.
$500 now, maybe raised more than that in the session. But this doesn't keep a landlord or anybody from going to court if they have a jurisdiction amount. But it does provide for a tenant that they will avoid certainly going to small claim for it. And if it's over $100, they can remove it.
$20,
from the Constitution, if you're. They can remove it by just giving notice at that time, and then they that takes it out. In the car.
Are we on 8 yet?
Yeah.
I should have asked Charlie before, but I don't think I can. Charlie, hit me with your argument of why we have to put on accountability laid out here. Isn't this the law anyway?
It probably is. It's nice to be able to tell a court that they can do these things. Some judges feel, especially in FEDs, that they have to go and enforce it regardless of what they feel may be unconscionable because the law is that way. That's the way Judge Davis felt in the case where there were almost 400 code violations. He said, well, I think the landlord's conduct's appalling, and but the law says we have to go ahead and enforce the agreement. I don't think it would substantially weaken the bill if that section were deleted, but it does spell out the contract, basic contract provisions of unconscionability do apply to landlord-tenant relationships.
Is there any further discussion on Section 8? All right, Section 13, regarding notice, been suggested to be stricken.
sticking the whole section in, right?
Who's the members are?
Oh, Dean worked on them, legislative council worked on them, Charlie Williams, and they worked on them together. And what, if you remember, our objective was to work in those half a dozen areas that we had considerable complaints about, try to simplify it. And I think they've done a pretty good job in meeting the criteria we set forth in our last meeting of SB 159.
Why did you feel the need to strike all of the section 13?
Well, there were no problems regarding notice. There are just basic notice provisions.
All of 13 is what I said.
All of 13.
What?
Oh, it is. It's old. The number is old.
That section really didn't directly relate to any of the problems that had been discussed.
Do you have a motion on that?
A motion is to delete section 13 and exist as the original bill. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, section 13 deleted. Now we're down to what is now known as section 9 under general provisions. Okay, terms and conditions of the rental agreement. Well, in the absence of the part there in 2, it is, in the absence of agreement sent to phase, there is the extended.
I'm assuming that since the section is only phase 5, that it's all new and none of this is in the middle of the
right.
I don't recall if there's anything.
The only amendments to existing law are contained in section, old sections 45 through 47.
Okay.
And that just amends the FED to conform with the act.
What is the present law? I've often really wondered, is the law now on vacation premises that the rent for the 30 days notice is expired, and notice is given, let's say, or person moved out, let's say they moved out without notice, and 15 days after they moved out, where the tenancy is month, someone else comes in. Well, it's never really been clear to me, but is the law in that situation that rent only for 15 days is still available, not the entire month?
If the tenancy is they're paying every 15 days.
Let's say it's a month-to-month tenancy. He moves out without notice, but and then there's a vacancy of 15 days, where the landlord gets a new tenant in 16 days.
I think he's obligated for the full 30 days.
Obligated for the full 30 days.
Yeah. And it seems reasonable there could be a mitigation in doing all other things like that.
Now, what does this mean then on line 32 of page 6? Unless otherwise agreed, granted uniformly apportionable to page 8. What's the meaning of that? That's what caused me to stop this.
I know one problem that's come up. Sometimes a tenant will pay part of his rent, and the landlord will accept that. The courts have sometimes ruled that if the landlord accepts part rent, that is the whole month, and the landlord can't evict him during that month, even because he's paid some rent for that month. I would imagine that would put the tenant behind in his rent when that much of the rent runs out. Part of the rent would only cover part of the month if it's apportionable from day to day.
All right.
So the bill just addresses itself to the thing that's been raised by Senator Cook that if a tenant moves out without giving 30 days notice, he's actually legally bound to pay the
actual period rate.
Well, old old Section 5 I believe places a burden on the on both parties to mitigate damages.
Okay.
That's Section 3 sub 2 now on page 2. No, sub 1.
Sub 1, it's on the top of page 2 there. The agreed party has a duty to mitigate damage. The top of page 2.
Chairman, let me ask another question. I mean, you know, we don't repeal any existing law. What effect does this have on our present statute relating to, you know, the presumptions and notice, or does it repeal?
There is a, in section 35, new section 35 on page 24, the provisions of 91, chapter 91.010 to 220 are exempted from applying to residential leases.
Wait a minute, are you on page 24?
You're on the new page.
New page 24.
Number 28. Page 24 at the bottom of the country.
So business leases and so forth would still be governed by existing law, but existing law would not apply to residential leases covered by this act.
Senator Greenspan, not being a lawyer, why is number two in the general provision in section 9?
Robert, it's the common law, I think, because there isn't any agreement written or agreement one way or another that the quantum merit is reasonable value.
Who decides that?
Of course.
What lawyer? Yeah, I know that's what you're leading up to.
Well, that provision doesn't have to be in there, but that.
No, it is.
No, it's important
there. Well, I think we've got some
anyway.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we've got Senator Cook and you have raised an interesting question of the effect of, unless otherwise agreed, we're in uniformly apportionable from day to day. I suppose the first answer would be that all you have to do is agree that you're renting month to month and you'd have the result that we have now. Is that right?
Well, up here in the top of page 7, unless the rental agreement fixes a definite term, the tenancy is week to week in the case of a roomer who pays weekly in, and all other cases month to month.
Okay, but you take, all right, take that plus the apportionable from day to day.
Now, before I forgot a lot of places.
That's the bottom of the teaching page, page 6. What I'm trying to get at is the question of the tenant decides he wants to leave, does he owe 30 days rent if it's a month to month tenancy, or does he owe the amount of rent that's due for the 3 days that he is there that month?
I wonder if we shouldn't really take it out. We don't know what the devil is about.
You talk about rent is uniformly enforceable from day to day?
Yeah.
I'm not sure where that's going to apply.
Well, if, for example, a tenant moved out, I think, after 3 days in violation of the agreement, and the landlord re-rented it on the 15th day, I suppose in assessing damages, you assess damages apportionable to the month.
I don't want to assess damages. I want to find out what happens to the rent. In other words, I agree, or that I'm on a month-to-month tenancy under 4, sub 4 and page 7. Can I find a better place to move or live or whatever, so I leave giving notice. Now, I'm required to give him 30 days, and I'll pay another 30 days, even if it's vacant, or if he re-rents it another day, a day later, I pay the 30 days, because that's the law as I understand it. What I'm trying to get at is, does this change it? I think it's a basic fairness in apportioning rent from day to day. On the other hand, if what we're trying to get at is the case of the landlord re-rent, which is really mitigation, as you say, not a damage, but it's a sense that he's overlapping the rent, he's getting double rent, and perhaps that's unfair. On the other hand, a month-to-month tenancy, and if the fellow can leave the first day of the month and say, okay, here's my $8, that's the apportioned 1/30th of the rent,
then we don't have month-to-month tenancy. We have, in fact, day-to-day tenancy.
Oh, yeah, I see.
And that, I don't know if we want to, under the, I don't know that it works that way. Does it work that way? Or, that's
I know it's not intended to work that way.
Yeah.
It seems to me that over there, where the section where it does require mitigation damage, that takes care of the situation that we're talking about here. And you just sort of take over.
Well, what I was saying, and there must be a way to, I don't like this sentence, because if you talk about the bottom of the page,
yeah,
because nobody knows what it's trying.
But I was thinking maybe we could substitute an idea, if we could get it in language, if we could say in the statute, in those cases where there is a repossession in a legal sense, where the landlord assumes the actually re-rents the premises, or in those cases where the landlord gives a 30-day notice, and let's say it ends in midway, and this is the thing I thought of, I don't know if everyone has a problem. You give a 30-day notice halfway through the month, the rental period. Well, what about the last 15 days? Well, that could be enforceable on a day-to-day basis. Now, this is a good idea if we make it specific. We say that in those cases where a determination is being made as to the amount of rent due to the landlord, where there he has taken possession of the premises, or has rented, re-rented the premises during the term that he is entitled to rent from the tenant, or where it's a break in the middle of a rental period, that rental will be apportioned from day to day. I mean, how do we say that? Well, there are various sections over here later on where we discuss the termination by the landlord and by the tenant for various reasons. And they're detailed enough that maybe we could aim at those longer sections.
Well, let's take this sentence out.
Well, I really think when we talk about mitigation damage, we probably cover the situation we're talking about, but this sentence doesn't include anything much.
I think that's right.
Well, I move that we delete the upcoming.
All right, the motion is to delete the last sentence on page 6, which reads, unless otherwise agreed, rent is uniformly enforceable from day to day. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right, the sentence is deleted.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Scully, where is this? One of the things that I like to see is one of the interesting things that the old common law worked on is that if you didn't give a full 30-day notice, you gave no notice at all. Remember that old bag that if you somehow you gave the wrong notice, there was no notice at all. Is it in here somewhere that the 30-day tenant from the time that the tenant gives notice even though they gave the premises, he's entitled to leave and owes no other rent? That's kind of what I thought. That's why I'd like to be apportionable from day to day. Let's suppose it's on the 14th month and I'm on an April 1 or 1 to 30 rent period. But I find a place, so on a move on the 14th of April, I give a 30-day notice. But that falls in between the normal month-to-month tenancy that we previously established. Are we clear that I can move in 30 days, or if I really
have
45 days, well, that's my concern.
Isn't the law that if you have to get a prior to time to get into the term, and then that's notice that you're going to vacate at the end of the next term?
That's the way it is in many states. But in Oregon, it's 30 days from whenever you give the notice.
Yeah, I think are we protecting that?
Page 23, new page 23. Section 32, sub 2. May change that.
23?
Yes, new page 23.
Okay, where is it then?
Section 32, sub 2.
Well, you're changing the law, making the notice the other way now.
Yeah,
you're
changing the best.
Changing to what it was at one time.
I always thought this was present law.
I don't
what you have
so.
Here.
Not the way the statute reads.
Oh, I think.
Well, maybe you just deleted before the last words in that sentence. The last after days, after 30 days, deleted everything else in that sentence, then would preserve that law.
And the about that a little bit.
The present Oregon law, if I'm not mistaken, says that you have to give 30 days notice, but it has to refer to a specific day. So I give notice 30 days before a date that's 30 days from now.
That's right. It has nothing to do with periodic right. Except as otherwise provided by statute or agreement, such tenancy may only, this is a month-to-month, may only be terminated by either the landlord or tenant giving to the other at any time during the tenancy.
Yeah.
Not less than 30 days notice in writing prior to the date designated the notice. Doesn't relate to the decision.
No.
I think that's a good point.
That's really a pretty good law.
What's the consent of the committee? You want to be able to give 30 days notice that you're going to terminate 30 days. Right.
Right. But we ought to make it clear. I think that I've always thought that is probably the law, although it's involving just small amounts normally. But you ought then to be able to, it ought to be clear to the tenant and to the landlord that if it's midpoint in a term, that they're going to apportion what is owed based on a daily basis. That's where this language should come in and help to clarify.
Okay, why don't we do that in section 32, sub 2, and sorry,
and put the old law back in. Yeah, we may want to put the old law
back. Well, let's make it specific, though, man.
But the tenancy shall terminate on the date designated and without regard to the expiration of the period for which, by the terms of tenancy and holding, rent should be paid.
What is that? What's the statute?
91070.
Then we ought to add.
Then we ought to add that uniformly apportionable day to day.
Right. And add that in the same section?
Yeah. Okay, put that on the end, make it clear so they know.
Okay. Now they've stricken all of section 15.
Testimony regarding problems with one side signing an agreement and the other side not signing an agreement. And that section really didn't relate to any of the problems the committee discussed last time. On the next page, there's two alternatives.
On attorney's fees?
On attorney's fees.
Okay. You're out of band right now.
Show you your day on the floor.
Boy.
Yeah.
If we leave that 90,000 the way it is, then if there is an agreement to pay attorney's fees, the tenant has a like agreement under the land law.
There, over the next page, there's two suggestions there, alternatives.
Do we want suit as well as action on 12?
I suppose so.
If you haven't, your alternative has been any suit or action.
Yeah.
but on your personal, you don't.
Yeah.
But if we just leave it all together, it would then allow them to make a provision for attorney's fees. But if there were agreements for attorney's fees for one party, then in general, all we have would allow for the other. This is about the last session. So if we put nothing in, it means that they can't have attorney's fees.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tenant, in turn, would have a equal right, even though it only is spelled out for the landlord.
If there's an agreement.
If there's an agreement.
If it provides for it, so. Attorney's fees with or without it.
Oh, with or without it. Well,
is that right, Charlie?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the only problem with that approach that Senator Cook mentions is that I think it would be possible then, the landlords invariably write the agreements. The only, if you leave it to the agreement, I think a landlord might be able to choose when he's going to be responsible for attorney's fees. For example, he could write only in eviction actions. Well, he'd be entitled to attorney's fees, and then only if he loses an eviction action would the tenant be entitled to attorney's fees. So I think if we're really going to have reciprocal attorney's fees, they should be reciprocal for everybody in every case and not allow one party to pick and choose when he'll be responsible for attorney's fees.
I think the strongest argument for the is to try to persuade people to remove it from the small claims court at the district court.
Question?
District court.
I'll go. Okay, I'll go to the next one.
All right, it's been moved that the second section 12 on new page 8. I guess we're a little bit ahead of ourselves. Let's do this one.
What do you say the strongest argument is?
I think the strongest argument for it, John, is to dissuade people from removing the small claims court. They got the district court. The small claims court, there are no attorneys. And a person in the small claims court now $4 for a little house. And but if one even the party removes it, then they're subject to the discretion court having attorney fees.
Well, another reason that one can argue in favor of this is because the generally the smaller the amount is that in the absence of this section there's no way we wouldn't really be able to afford it in time.
Are you satisfied with that notwithstanding any agreement to the contrary over a rental agreement where the tenants are agreeing?
I can't read that.
Well, would it take precedence over language relating to attorney's fees?
Well, section 10 on the previous page said a tenant that may not provide for tenants to waive or forego rights under the Act.
All right, any further discussion on the new section 12? All those in favor of adding new section 12, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. The second one on page 2. Okay, let's go back. We got a little bit ahead there.
Chairman, I guess
we're on section 10.
Yeah. See, I'd like to turn to talk a little bit on that.
Yeah, I marked it too.
Normally, and of course, it's frequently done commercially, but and sometimes done in a residential lease. For the tenant to save the landlord harm for once its possession is turned over, agrees to holding harmless. For any injury to guests of the tenant or anything else that would occur in the house. That kind of thing, what I'm worried about is once you give control to the tenant, then it puts the landlord in kind of a bad spot to maintain the premises and pick up the debris and mend the steps and do those things. Sometimes required, and if somebody falls and is injured, what happens with it?
Well, that's really not a serious problem that we've come up against, if you wanted to delete that.
But where are you talking about?
The commissioners say that clauses attempting to exculpate the landlord from tort liability for his own wrong have been declared illegal by statutes in some states, Massachusetts and New York. Such provisions, even though unenforceable at law, may nevertheless prejudice and injure the rights and interests of the uninformed tenant.
Okay, if that's what they're getting at, if they're getting at, I can understand if the landlord puts in a lease, if something happens to you, because if the water flows up and it's my negligence, you agree not to sue me because of my negligence. I understand that that's been, in my view, unconscionable. But I'm fearful that this goes a lot further than that. This goes as third people.
If the landlord is negligent, maybe you just put in if you want, we can work that language over to try and limit those.
Well, if you could, I'd like to see it, because I would agree if it's expressed into declare void or unenforceable any provision that the landlord attempts to make himself immune from his own negligence as it relates to the tenant. Fine, but I kind of need to see the tenant passing off some third-party injury right on up to the landlord if it's something that the tenant is doing.
How would this occur?
Well, I don't know, but it's normal in most places that I've seen, particularly commercial, but also in some residential, where the landlord asks or requires the tenant to hold him harmless for injuries resulting from the occupancy of the premises. I don't think that's necessarily unconscionable. In fact, I don't think it is unconscionable from the standpoint that the tenant has possession. He's in control.
Yeah, I think that would do it, or just leaving that section out and letting existing law apply.
They don't know what the law is, and they could put it in the agreement. If they does put it in, they don't want to do it. Do it. We even argued it, of course. As a matter of fact, I researched that one case. It was a very uncomfortable case. I think I researched it and found the case that they could go into the liability. It was not contrary to public policy, so if we don't want to do it, we better say it. I move in substance
that
the language on line 22 through 24 be amended so that it will further provide that the landlord may not be in a rental agreement under this act with the landlord. The tenant agrees that the landlord shall not be liable for his own breach of warranty or negligence.
All right, you heard the motion and the discussion. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, those opposed. So amended.
Charlie, you drafted a specific land use correct. I think the way it works, the data probably doesn't. It's a wrinkle in the way. Things are changing very kind of the problem. Now, there's a suggested amendment on line 27, page 7. The landlord deliberately uses a rental agreement containing provisions known by him to be prohibited and attempts to enforce such provisions. And it goes on to tenant may recover in addition to, and it's not that part of the change. And the reason most tenancies are stricken out is provided for in the new section 12. Is that correct? Sorry.
That's correct. Every other reference in the statute to attorney fees, I believe, has been stricken.
Okay. To remove the word written in there, following and below line 27 of page 7 be adopted. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed? And adopted. And we've already taken care of 12 of our page 8, new page 8. And now we're on new page 9, section 13. Charlie, you got property left in sub 2, but you took it out in sub 3. That's at line 5 and line 14.
Should be taken out in sub 2 as well.
Are you reading that for what reason?
Don, this is something that we agreed. That it just, we've never had a case where there was property as a deposit and it's invariably money.
All right. We're on page, the new page 9, I guess, here, section 13, and the word property in sub 2 should have been stricken as it was down in sub 3. That's at line 5 and line 14. And the other amendment there is to change from 14 days to 30 days, line 10. Now, the reason is this is referring to security as far as property is concerned. There's been no instance where property would be given security or money. I don't want to say strike it, but could be that, I suppose.
The reason for the 30 days, that is from the landlord's house bill, 2424. I guess theoretically, after a month, some other utility bills or something like that might come in that a landlord would want to use as an offset.
I guess typographical error on that 13.
Does this section that asked that I was being in there?
Or
is it big? I guess that's right. Mr. McClure said this several times.
Do we have a comma also after tenancy 1-5 upon the termination of tenancy comma?
I'll be right back. Okay. Senator Meeker?
On line 5, after the word tenancy, there's a comma and then the word property more are deleted.
Well, no, we. It was down in section 3, the subsection 3. The reason why they deleted property was they didn't know of any instance where property was put up in lieu of money as security. But it seems to me that it's a feasible thing to occur. And if it occurred, I don't see why we want to delete it, because we don't know of an instance.
Store it back on.
So you want to restore
on 14.
But let's do this. Senator Carson moved that on line 5, after the tenancy, we put in a comp. Now, property is still in it. And on line 10, it's up to 30 days to 14 days. line 13 of be changed to or, on line 15 together with damages is stricken, and on line 16 and reasonable attorney fees is stricken. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay.
You know, I think we ought to consider this. We have this general provision in this section 12. It looks to me like it would cover any suitor action under this agreement. Yet in various places we've got double and triple damages. Now, what is the intent of the committee? Is it our intent that you're going to allow double and triple damages in addition to attorney fees, or are you thinking that double and triple damages in place of
it? Well, no, attorney fees are there for a party that prevailed in the by the adoption of that section 12. And that's separate from any award of damages specifically provided for you. Am I right,
Doug?
The National Conference had provided for triple damages, and the deletion of together with damages on line 15 makes it only double damages, because they felt there has to be some impetus to give make landlords give back those deposits. That's really the only impetus there is.
Any further discussion? Okay, on the section 14. I have a question mark here after some at line 27. Landlord starting out above the landlord or any person authorized that any of the relatives that they have come close to the tenant in writing at or before the commencement has been named and address out. Person authorized to manage an owner of the premises or a person authorized to act for and on behalf of the owner for the purpose of service process proceedings. Well, I guess that's right. I guess that should be in there. All right, are there any, okay, person who fails to comply with such differences of an agent of these persons who is landlord for? All right. Is there any discussion on the new section 14, which is old section 19?
Who's in there?
No, there's no amendment on that.
Well,
is it?
No, I'm ready.
I
was section 20 was taken out.
Okay, right. Section 20, yeah. Why was it taken out?
Well, I think just existing law would apply to that, or general contract principles.
Okay. Senator Gerstead moves that section, rule section 20 be stricken. All of the favor signify by saying aye. On section 15, we had the considerable discussion of what habitable meant, and I think this has been taken from the, what's the number of the bill?
2424.
HB 2424, is that right? Is this been lifted out of their intact version here?
Well, there's a couple of minor changes. That one thing that is not, I believe, in your copies, is before lacks, it should say substantially.
Where is it?
On the third line of the typing, before the word lacks.
Is it substantially lacks?
Right, and that is from the, from 2424. As we talked about last time, a couple of things were added, the adequate on the next page, on the first line of page 11. Adequate before heating. It's not contained in the in House Bill 2424. And then H, I, and J, we inserted walls, ceilings, I guess just walls and ceilings to be maintained in good repair and structurally sound, we added. And then I and J were added.
Thank you.
last thing, I believe the rest is from House Bill 2424, and D on page 12 we added, and you may want to delete that.
All right. And that other language on page 12 is from 2424, right?
Right.
Let me read.
Page 11, number J, lines of reasons and purposes of the fire code. No, there's probably the state capital that means fire.
Well, it says materially affecting health and safety.
Isn't there a general planning of the fire code that they're all for health and safety?
Well, they are. I think it's modified in that way. It says materially affecting health and safety. I think. We know in a, I'm sure in the house that I own with a house that's 73 years old. We've done rewiring the basement, we've done rewiring on the attic, and certain portions of the first floor. The second floor, we haven't done anything, the bedrooms and so forth. I'm sure that's applied to the code. I don't see any problem with safety, however, material safety problems.
That's the case why it's part
for new construction. And we know more now than we provide case than we could before.
I'm not trying to relate this one. Just one.
I think your question brings into a quite difficult situation. I felt the word materially takes care of the type of thing we had objections to from landlords that have an older premise sometimes, and they're not talking about bare wire, we're not talking about any wire being short from that. If it's going to be changed for some reason like that now, it has to be come up to code. But they don't have to change it just to bring it up to code. Is that what you aimed at by having?
Right. Senator Burns suggested that we put this in at the last meeting. Senator John Burns. I don't want the law to do what Senator Meeker suggests. I don't think the draft is intended that. But I think a landlord should be under some obligation to provide fire extinguishers or some of the minimum things that codes provide.
Over on page, new page 12, we are getting off that center even just for purposes of discussion here, and we'll, any change what we may will be when we move to adopt or fail to be in full effect.
Mr. Chairman? That is, through C on page 12 is from House Bill 2424.
D is added.
Well, I would see Senator Carson as being that anything of that nature he'd have to complete, even though he's going to be a test before he's going to be a test. That's the intent. If that's really a stumbling point, I think the problem is that if people could just get out of all of their obligation under this section, if they put in a lease agreement that the tenant is obliged to do all these things, all of the obligations of the landlord.
Well, the only thing about it, I understand that, and I don't appreciate that, but on the other hand, was easier time, and expected the whole period of federal programs to be built on what they call sweat equity, where the rent actually includes, for instance, I'm thinking of a manager of a mobile apartment. Part of his responsibility for a cheap rent or a no rent is to make this repair.
This wouldn't apply to him. This bill, he's exempted under the exemption. I believe so. If employment is.
Mr. Chairman, for the absence of this substitute, it doesn't do any favor. Because when people leave, but to retirement, because the landlord intended to.
I think with the rest of that, of the new section 15, I'm of the impression that he'd be prohibited from doing what subsection 2 permits him to do in section 12 down through C.
I think that's correct. If it weren't for subsection 2, Senator Meeker, no agreement could be entered into by the landlord for the tenant to make repairs. Well, I think that the first part of Section 21 would prohibit that. And also, the section that prohibits a tenant from waiving his rights under the Act. Section
2 10. Gives him something. Section 2 by itself gives him something. A, B, and C. Limits that.
Section 10 says a rental agreement may not provide that a tenant agrees to waive or forego rights under the Act.
Which section 10?
The new section 10 on page 7, sub 1A.
Discussion on the proposed new section 15.
Last thing, maybe crack. may or may not have anything to do with water protection and our water within the watershed.
Maybe you just took out including unbroken.
Well, that's what I was going to do, but then I was thinking, well, wait a minute, we want waterproofing and weather protection for roofs, tier walls, and I would agree including windows and doors. But the key is whether they provide waterproofing and weather protection, not whether they have a crack in the paint. So why don't we just take out, I'll move that we take out unbroken. So the emphasis is put on whether or not it provides waterproofing and weather protection.
All right, you've heard the motion. Discussion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, so no, no.
Oh, you're
the last one. Last one. Damn it, we don't have my house. I was the last
one. Mr. Chairman, on page 11, I've heard part of the criticism of aye, and I think a comma would help. I would then read ventilating, air conditioning, and other facilities and appliances, including elevators, comma, maintained in good repair if supplied or required to be supplied by the landlord.
You want a comma after repair?
After elevators.
Oh, you have, okay. Moving good repair, right.
The first person that called me on it said, am I now required to provide an elevator for my two-story duplex? And I said, I didn't think so. But I've since received several calls and concerns here in the capital that it would appear that we're requiring landlords to provide ventilation, air conditioning, other facilities and appliances, including elevator pumps. And that's not the intent. Because if they provide them, they must be offered.
And is there an objection to adding a comma after elevator? Or you know that's a comma. Is there any further comments?
On J, on page 11, maybe substantially instead of materially would help Senator Meeker. His.
I'm sorry, I
just suggested that maybe substantially instead of materially in J would help make that less of a problem.
I'm not.
Uniform Act said you had to have a separate agreement. You couldn't have it included in your rental agreement. And I was supposed, you could do it that way.
Well, I'm not going to fight the language. It's prominently disclosed just means that they're not buried in some minuscule type space down the bottom. The whole thing you're trying to get.
I think that's right.
Okay, let me, I didn't hear the latter question. I would think probably
the first 15 seconds, right?
Where you said clearly and probably disclosed would seem like fairly disclosed would be better. And that means it can't be a smaller size, it has to be at least same size size. Or did you discover the probably did mean something?
No, I I know what they're trying to get at, and I don't object to what they're trying to get at. I think fairly would be it.
Why don't we put the word?
Because I need to have an argument whether the paragraph at the bottom of the page is more prominent than the paragraph at the top of the page.
And the car who moves the substitute the word fairly in
paragraph
C of the new page 12, any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
And that also includes the striking M and CC and
putting a semicolon at the end of C, the end of the
word. Way of the way now?
Well, it's the limited count. Obviously, D was added, and B is...
Okay, semicolon at the end of C.
Yeah.
And so the word and.
The end of B and add the end.
Okay. Okay. All of the things you'd like to say, aye. Opposed. All right. And we got a motion of second 15.
So we've adopted each one of the amendments that we went along.
No, it's all. We got to strike the old section. Okay, here's all we need a motion to do. Strike old section 21 and 22 and adopt new section 15.
Certainly.
Okay. Then move. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Neal.
Question about the procedures. Chair is intent to let the bill lay over a while and then back to it.
I don't plan on moving this out today, but it's not going to. We're over now on new section 16, old 23, on page new 13. Well, I suppose they're dealing with those situations where they have a certain common quarters, but portions of exclusive living quarters. Is that correct?
This was taken from the landlord's bill. The only thing it deleted was a requirement that the tenants comply with all the codes. House Bill 2424 didn't require the tenants to comply with the codes, and it doesn't require the landlords to comply with the codes. And they inserted this language. They also inserted a little more language saying it shall be used only at the tenant's abode, but that's already included in another section of the Act, so we just used their language here.
What about the general statement that abide by the laws, what I think of the criminal law, for instance, what looks like an easy one, not saying kind of a holy brothel. What if an enterprising tenant commences a brothel? Is that a violation of the perfect code? There's no commercial prohibition here. You might violate some zoning ordinance, but. How does the landlord who doesn't support that kind of activity terminate the tenancy in this situation? Normally, normally a provision if a tenant agrees to abide by the law. That may seem kind of redundant, but the fact is, if the tenant doesn't, then that's a ground for the landlord to pull him out. Is that handled somewhere? I don't recall it is.
There's no prohibition against that being put into a rental agreement as well.
What I'm thinking about here is we're writing a rental agreement. We're thinking of those things that landlord and tenant don't do.
You really ask them if they cannot commit an unlawful act on the premises.
Well, what I'm doing is I'm setting up if they do unlawful act on the premises, I'm setting it up as the ground for the landlord is.
You'd run the risk of getting into those minor things like a poker game or something.
Yeah.
Well,
I won't press it, but I
Mahoney and I are all right on that line.
Down in item 7, sub 7, on page 13. I'm thinking it seems though there ought to be a perhaps a different standard. I don't know, it might be bad to look at it like this the act of for the rent people have children. It seems like you certainly have a different standard than you would for people don't have children. And I don't know if it's important. I think you put that in there and it cause more people to be to rent.
I'd like to have that on owner-occupied house. Include cats and dogs, I'd really be for it. And motorcycles and snowmobiles.
All right, the changes in section, the old section 23, new section 13 is paragraph. Have you struck out something, haven't you?
What was it that you took out on?
Did we get to see what you took out, Charlie?
Where is this?
Number 1.
That's top page?
It used to be page 42, it's page 3.
It said the tenant shall comply with all obligations primarily imposed upon tenants by applicable provisions of building and housing codes materially affecting health and safety. And the vagueness of that language and the code compliance was deleted for landlords, and so we deleted it for tenants.
Okay. Senator Carson moved when we strike old section 1 of old section 23 and amend by adding the new section 1, new section 16.
But the perfect thing is the language is not here.
Oh yeah, that's part of the motion. That's part of the motion. Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay. Section 17, there are no changes. Just renumbering. Section new 18, there's no changes. 19. Notice if at the time he enters into the rental agreement or when it is adopted. Is that what you're referring to?
No, we're pro or an access.
We're access again.
Section or sub 3, line 16.
Okay.
The
landlord shall not abuse the right of access?
Right. Except in case of emergency or unless it is impractical to do so, the landlord shall give the tenant at least 2 days notice. I'm wondering about the propriety of making 2 days.
Do you think 24 hours is enough?
Well, why do you
get
it?
They get a bow.
You get a bad thing.
Yeah, I get a bad thing with that.
Mr. Chairman, in several places in your charter, there's references about section 1 to 44. Then there's only 41.
Yeah, we discussed that earlier, and they're going to let the council see that.
Did you want to change the 35 to me?
Well, What do you mean the last sentence of sub 3 for at all? The last sentence of sub 3.
Okay.
The landlord shall not abuse the right of access or use it to harass the tenant.
Period.
Well, I think it's good guideline to have something like that. If there was a dispute about what, left a dispute about what's reasonable, I think it's good to have it. I think it creates a problem now. And I'm not hung up on whether it be 48 hours or 24 hours. That doesn't bother me, but I think it's good to have a guideline. Anything else, Senator Carter?
Mr. Chairman, Charlie, remember the what I was struck by during the testimony was the question of case of emergency or suspected emergency. Remember the cases where they thought there might have been smell smoke or whatever the case, and I realized maybe that opening the door wider than one open, maybe this was fine, but. Your understanding would be that it would be what the, in case of an emergency, or what did landlord reasonably believe to be an emergency? I need to have the landlord really believe that there's a fire in the bedroom of the tenant, and not really know whether it's emergency or not, so decided he had to wait till he sees flames or sees smoke or whatever. And they were only too broad a touchy area, I realize.
Well, you really think it could have been right out of the fire, it's better than you do the hood.
Well, there are two examples of the one where, I think we have some testimony, the landlord saved a man's life. Because he thought it had smoke and had fallen asleep in the bed. The other time we had some testimony that there was one landlord that periodically thought there was an emergency when he heard his female tenant shower. And boy, it's hard to draw a lesson for you to leave the line on that one. But, let's just leave it on.
All right, any further discussion on section 18? What about 19?
Yeah.
Now it's 20 now. You struck out materially affecting health and safety because they put that in.
Well, section 21 was completely reworded that says there has to be a substantial lack of one of those specific items. So I think that's covered.
All right.
What is that?
Right.
That's 15. The last sentence on sub 2 on page 15, that's line, the end of line 20 and 21, 22, because it provided for that elsewhere. And on line 26, section 18 should be section 3. All right, is there any discussion on the
and then section 20, 4.7. We need an amendment to strike the words on line 34 from page 14 and the last sentence of subsection 2 on page 15, send a card and so
forth. 28 might as well.
And section 21 to section 15 and some other section on there, 13, let's break that down, take care of. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Yeah. Section 28.
That entire section should be deleted. That three lines at the bottom, I think, should be crossed out.
Three lines from up to Billiken?
Right.
Okay, what's the idea of knocking out this business on delivery today?
Well, there were no problems that the committee heard testimony on or wanted to deal with at the last meeting regarding the failure to deliver possession. So we took those out.
I don't recall any complaints on that. And all of section 28 is supposed to be deleted.
Removed.
All of section, hold section 28 be deleted. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, now we're down to self-help for minor defects. The new section, what is that, 21?
Right.
Give them no suggested changes. So we heard a lot of complaints that the way the landlord's been dealing with it is to evict the tenant.
Well, this is taken from House Bill 2424. The section provides some fairly stiff penalties for landlords if essential services are denied to tenants. This would say that they have to be deliberate or grossly negligent in supplying those services before a tenant was entitled to these particular remedies. Basically, it was the amendment was intended to soften the effect of the section. This section does not read now like House Bill 2424. They softened it a good deal further, but it would seem that if a landlord is deliberate or grossly negligent in cutting off such an essential services, these remedies are justified.
Senator,
do you think then that this takes care of the problem where power can be shut off the power? If the landlord can't do anything about the heat.
Well, I don't think he's deliberately refusing to do anything.
Well, he is, if he has the obligation to pay the bill, he doesn't.
Well, if that's the reason they turned it off, right?
I'm talking about community things.
Might be close to negative than we have,
because there are some tenants who complain about that. So,
all right, the only suggested amendment to the new section 22 is substituting the language on line 27, deliberately refuses or is close to negligent failing, and strikes mm-hmm. willfully or negligently failed. And on the next page, line 9, the words and in any case under subsection 1 of this section, reasonable attorney's fees. Senator Carson still moved. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
Chairman, could I also ask to take out the word gas on line 28? And the reason, my reason, well, it appears in line 28 and 31, and I'm not trying to convert everybody to oil or some other thing, but I would hate to have a tenant decide that he wants a charcoal broiler with gas and say, I want gas service, I want gas service. And then the landlord deliberately refuses to provide gas service in the end of the thing. I think.
Where are you? It's back on page, the new page. I can't read it. The section 21.
Yeah.
Section 22.
New 22.
New section 22.
But what it would be is you leave our other essential service. So if gas is running the stove, if gas is running hot water, then that would be an essential service.
I think it was maybe see something from the oil he uses to other things.
Well, it's on a different area, but it touched on the minute we start specifying. So I'll move to delete gas on line 28 and 31.
Okay. Any discussion? Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Section 23, suggested that the last sentence mentioned on line 28 runs through 29 and 30 be deleted. And that's on attorney fees, which we provide elsewhere. Senator Carson still moves. All of the states signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. Now we propose that we delete section 32.
Old section 32.
Yeah, old section 32.
Need a motion?
Yep. The move that we delete old section 32 for this. Any discussion? Well, look at this first. I can't remember what it the reason you're leaving this because we didn't hear any complaints about it, right?
Right.
The remedy's rather obvious, is that it? All right. Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor, the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right. Section 32 is done. Now, the new section 24. They have reduced the treble damages to double damages and stricken reasonable attorney fees because it's provided for elsewhere. So we're striking the word three on line 22, substituting the word two, and the word threefold, and substituting the word twice, and reasonable attorney fees on 23 and 24. Senator Beeman so moved. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
I move to make it 24, you said 2 and 12.
Alright, now we're over to, beginning now, new section 25, over on page 19, I guess, new page 19. And, it was proposed that, in addition to the reasonable attorney fees being stricken, you've got to take care of the new section 12, that the 14 days be reduced to 10 days on line 12. So the rent is unpaid and due is head of state rent within 10 days. I guess that's because it's been 24-24, is that why you put 10 days in it? And that's existing law,
Well,
24th, the House does 24th and
all. This would require notice that if yeah. before, and the existing law doesn't require right. that.
Senator Meeker, so moved. Or does anybody care about 10 days and 14 days?
10 is fine.
That is adjourned then, so. Any discussion? Any friends? All those favors in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right, now what we've done there, we've changed the word, the letters, the new numbers 14 to 10 on line 13. We'll stick at the last sentence there on sub 3. Any discussion on section 26, 27, not about the new section, 28, 29.
Under some Supreme Court decisions in Oregon, a landlord doesn't have to proceed under a landlord's lien to take a tenant's furniture. He theoretically could get away without posting notice. And it's just a common law right to take a tenant's belongings, which the Supreme Court said was not abolished when the landlord lien statute was enacted. So this common law right would be abolished by that sentence.
Senator Meeker?
Mr. Chairman, what can we hear some arguments about section 29, new section 29?
Yeah, that's they're discussing part of that.
What other manner can landlord get rent?
A landlord would have all ways that any creditor can get his rent. He just wouldn't be able to take a tenant's furniture and other belongings from him without first having a hearing. He also would have a security deposit. As a practical matter, landlord's liens have been held unconstitutionally in several states, and I believe it would be in Oregon if the court made a decision on it.
As a practical matter, they don't work. The process doesn't work at all. And frankly, I've seen as a landlord that started to do so without attorney having experience in this matter, in which you have to start costing more money than what you say. Any further discussion? 29. All right, we got some. We turn over to page 21 and 22. This deals with the same problem to the extent where there are one famous witness here, but the property that they abandoned, personal property, wasn't worth anything. He couldn't dispose of it. Except he hauled it to court by Quapa besides verdict. The deal for that situation generally.
Will this provide present?
Pardon me, sir?
Is present statutory procedure for disposition of abandoned personal property?
Now, what is the present law?
Sheriff sale, I get it one.
You mean a sheriff sale?
Well,
yeah.
You've got to advertise.
Okay, I lifted this almost completely from the landlord's bill. I didn't
see. You know, I checked. You sure didn't say I'm a student.
Okay.
And I would suggest that sub A, sell the property in public sale, you'd better tie that into an existing decision because there are different kinds of public sales, you know, sale.
Actually, I would have no objection if I don't know how the committee feels, but having a private sale of this as well, as long as it's conducted in a commercially reasonable manner. On the next page, I inserted that language.
Well, I think to me that would be a lot simpler because you are in dire deficit to conversion to comply with all the requirements of notice.
One thing that I'm a little bit concerned about sub B being used for retaliatory purposes.
For what?
For retaliating against a tenant. A little bit reluctant to leave it solely to the landlord's discretion that determines the value of the property below. And on the market, it might be very low, but to the tenant, it can be a substantial loss. I don't know how you handle it. Bottom a little bit. Did that concern anybody with Charlie?
Yes, we were concerned, but we felt that was something the committee wanted to deal with the last
hearing.
Well,
I think we did want to deal with it. I'm not sure we wanted to deal with it this way. It bothered me that to disturb any other members of the committee. We were solely in the landlord and someone had a reason for that. Pardon me?
I'd prefer not to adopt.
You mean the whole thing or that's the whole thing? Well, then we're left with, well, then if we don't have,
you're left with the sheriff.
It's, well, and that shifts it back the other way. You have a sheriff sale for some heavy value, perhaps.
Yeah, this, Chairman, I'm convinced this is one of the worst parts of the present law. This is something we inherited from the common law, and it's just untenable. The sheriff's sale is ridiculous.
It's a common sarcasm against the sheriff.
I expect they have a bill on that, but
you're limiting the number of sheriffs.
You're limiting nine sheriffs. But this is really a problem, and I think we need something like this in here, and I what's the matter with it?
Well, you're saying an abstraction.
I tell you, this is going to take a little bit of time, I think, to resolve it. I wonder if Senator Burns, John Burns, and Senator Carson work on it.
When do you want to report?
Let's see, we don't meet till Thursday.
So we'll do that.
Wednesday's an easy day, well, a long time before.
You get me to do this at 9 o'clock,
Would you excuse me too? How about just sitting down with Charlie and John just for a couple of minutes and give them some ideas and so we can input to the committee and we'll work on it. All right?
No.
Senator John Byrne, expert on the sheriff, you know, so send the card.
At least they originated in history or something. And Charlie, you'll, John, you take the initiative to talk to Senator John Byrne and Senator Carson. Okay?
You find the
you better check those.
Put it on the
floor.
All right. Was there any other particular problems with these 2 pages of amendments other than that? Except for Senator Lucas General, concerns in the whole world.
Well, I think the subcommittee is busy with stuff and getting one more vote, and that's all we need to do.
Let's see. Now we're on page 30 on new page 20. Remedy after termination. And the attorney fee thing is to be stricken there. Still moved by Senator Carson. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, now we're on new section 31, which begins on new page 20. And continues over after those 2 pages of amendments on page, new page 23. There's no suggested amendments there. A little gas in here again. New page 23. Line 1, the first word. Do you have an amendment on that, Senator Carson?
Right.
New page 23, line 1, the first word. Motion strike gas.
Yeah. Probably too much gas.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Okay, section, new section 32. Let's see, we did something on this. Oh, yeah, we already handled it, didn't we?
Somehow we jumped over here.
No, we brought that
whole extra
uniformity of portions one day thing, that sentence, and put it on the end of sub 2. And also, we're going to have an amendment come back and start on this. So they're going to set up the great 30-day notice that you terminate the tenancy after 30 days notice, and
right.
It doesn't involve the period of the tenancy,
right.
And also that uniformly enforcement deal. And why don't we have a motion to adopt that in context? Okay, so Senator Martin, so moved. Any discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
All right.
Those opposed? Okay, the motion is adopted now. The ORS section on that's 90, ORS 91. 0.070 time. You got that?
Yes,
come back to specific language, okay? John?
Don.
I hear that too, but I start to call you Don. He's consistent throughout the meeting. Okay. And also in that section, we'll change the new consistent time. We've reduced the 2 to 3 to 2 and threefold spikes and cut out reasonable attorney fees and set the card still moved and discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye. And that included the amendment on attorney fees on section 33. Is that correct, Senator Carter? Okay. Yeah. Okay. The retaliatory conduct section. We're suggesting an amendment over on line 13 on new page 24. We're gaining page 24. We reduced from 1 year to 6 months. That was suggested by Senator John Byrne, I think. Is that correct?
Right.
So moved.
Right.
Discussion.
An increase in rent is a compensatory win.
When they do it to retaliate.
No. $5, $10.
Oh, you mean how much? I don't know. Ask you a question of fact. What language were you at specifically?
Well, it says.
Oh, what page? Move 24?
No. Right after it says, Salutary Comment, Section 34. Acceptance of life, landlords do not retaliate by increasing rent. And I don't see any provision for what.
Well, it's going down here.
Section 41 on the last page, I put in a statute of limitations. We
that's the 1 year, right?
Right. This 6 month time limit, the retaliatory eviction section in this act and in the House bill are quite different. I think the House bill section is practically worthless, but they did have a 6 month limitation, so I thought this might, this shortening this presumption of retaliation would make the act a little more palatable to landlords. A landlord could still show that his rent increase or his eviction or anything else that he did was not retaliatory. It's just that the burden would not be upon the tenant to try and prove the landlord's intent. The landlord would have to prove his own intent.
And for specific acts, there on A, and we get a complaint to a governmental agency.
Well, I have problems with those.
I raised three to four problems for you.
What's a tenant mean? Well, I don't know. There are tenant unions in Oregon, I guess. The equivalent of it's where tenants get together to discuss grievances, and there have been cases where they have withheld rent, placed in trust, where they've got together to do joint action against a landlord. Where collectively they do a service to an attorney to justify one single complaint. That's actually.
Why do you have any, Chairman, sorry, what's the theory behind the 6 months or the 1 year? That's the key to kicking off the presumption. And if you have a complaint, there is no presumption. But if you have a complaint in 6 months, actually complain to anybody, really. Just about.
Well, it's desirable to have a time limit in there. I don't know, I think 6 months is reasonable. Okay. 3 months is a little bit short to me. Years in a row, 6 months sound reasonable. I don't know who's here. Someone said Senator John Burns did. I denied it. But he did make a motion.
That's
motive I don't recall any votes on that one.
You did? Was there a four vote for it? Oh.
No, I don't think they were all the same.
But I changed the one year thing.
We're all faced with a staffing problem that I don't.
Is there any further discussion on amendment new section 34?
Mr. Chairman, I have a real problem with that. I will work out.
All right. Section 35. There's one proposed amendment. On new page 25, line 21, changing 14 days to 10. Senator Carter so moved. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. Now, there are no. There's one. A new section 41. We do have more than 40 seconds. Senator John Burns moves that we amend Senate Bill 159 by adding section 41, limitation of action. An action arising under this act or under a renovation shall be commenced within 1 year. Discussion.
Good.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right. What I would like you to do, if there are things of substantial need, if you feel you would favor this, passing this before the new pass recommendation, except for some substantial objection to it, I'd like to know. Because there's no sense in us working and working and working on the money in there.
Are you going to engross it?
Well, let's get to I. Senator,
I think it's going to proper to allow some of those people who have testified both sides of this and change the vote.
Do you think we have the bill reprinted at this point for the minutes?
Well, I would think so.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Well, I tell you, there was we had a couple of before we do that, we adopted one thing in concept.
And it was supposed to be another.
And I think we ought to get those back. And let's get those. Can we get those back by Thursday? And then we could then we can put the bill out there today.
Okay.
Just bring it back. Bring it back to committee on Thursday. And then we'll kind of have to see those things and adopt them in context. Okay? Now everybody's going out the door all the time.